Welcome back to the Why Hockey, periodically enjoying hockey and not caring about what's said on Twitter podcast.
Well, that's a good way of focusing on it. I was going to say, periodically wondering which villain from Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego stole all the Jaromir Jagr bobbleheads.
Honestly, if I'm Sidney Crosby, this is the straw that breaks my back. For everything that I've done for this organization, the only person who's done more for that organization is Mario Lemieux saying, "Yeah, you don't have to pay me right now." That is like the only thing better than what Crosby has done. And this, they've done it. Pittsburgh has made me feel bad for them. I feel bad for a Pittsburgh Penguin. I feel bad for Sidney Crosby. Heck, I feel bad for Eric Carlson too, and Letang, and even Evgeny Malkin. The front office, I think, and the ownership allowing the front office is so bad. But bobblehead, sure. Let's go to the Comcast thing of just throwing stupid, funny content at people.
I have to say, my guess for the best Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego villain, because it's Jagr, this is the early 90s, it makes perfect sense, right? Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego is one of the best game shows of all time. We have to go with Wonder Rat. You have to, because think about it. When was that last great Penguins team? When did it end? Who ended it?
I mean, which last great Penguins team?
I'm thinking of the 96 team that, to death.
I don't know if you could say that's the last great team.
Of
that era, yeah. And they had the rat tails. I mean, they had the rat tails when they played.
This is true. That would be true. Also, you know, Vic the Slick, that's another good one. We gotta have a one for there. And also,
I personally think it's Kansas City. I think that would be maybe the most Scooby-Doo-esque twist. It's Kansas City.
I see what you're saying. I get it. Okay.
It's Kansas City stealing the bobblehead.
It's the Kansas City Chiefs fan who dressed up in a wolf mask who turned out to be a giant thief.
You know what?
I'll give you credit for that. I like the idea. I like what you're thinking. I don't even think you know what I'm referring to. This was a Chiefs fan on Twitter who goes to a game in like a wolf mask and ended up becoming like a very large thief and is now in prison. It's very, very funny.
That's a great story. I'd have to read back. I remember hearing about it, but I don't remember the details. When I think of wolf and hockey, I think of the Sudbury Wolves having a taxidermied wolf go on a zip line. Not a zip line. It would be cool if it was a zip line, but they kind of rig it up to a line and
I know what you're talking about.
From the corner of the arena up top all the way out to center of the ice and then back.
I'll have to ask Brock McGillis about that because he's from Sudbury.
Yeah, I don't know if they still do that or not. I feel
me they probably don't.
They've taken a lot of fun out of hockey and stuff.
Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego villain stealing the Jaromir Jagr bobbleheads? And the good news is because they were found, that means the kid went and did the IDing on a map of all of the countries and capitals in 40 seconds to get a trip to anywhere in North America. Look, beautiful. I could reference that show all day. It's really good, really memorable. Rockapella's incredible.
I just know, like, the Windows 97 computer game.
Well, that's also good, too. Like, the very good stuff. I appreciate that, but to me, it's the game show. Where in Time isn't as good. Not quite as good, a little bit goofier. Because it's got that, you know, mid-late 90s. You remember that time when, like, everything all suddenly got futuristic? Because we were approaching the year 2000, and so everything had the graphics and the set designs that were like this very dated version of the future because of what was approaching in pop culture. Where in Time, not quite as good. Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? Incredible show. Truly.
All right, that's enough. That's enough.
Anyway, I wanted to start with that because I thought, you know, how we could connect two early 90s things in our minds, and that was my easiest way of doing it. Well, the Penguins are definitely not making the playoffs this year.
I could talk 20 minutes about the TV show Ghost Rider.
You could, yes. There's nothing wrong with that. Since the Penguins are not making the playoffs because they have the bottom's fallen out. How did you go bankrupt gradually, then suddenly? We should talk about teams that are going to be going to the playoffs. Although one that's not playing particularly great of late. As we start this discussion, I hope all of you enjoyed Travis Yost on the show a couple of weeks ago. I promised a first-time guest, and I gave you a first-time guest, a Why Hockey listener, Tommy, and I loved his reasoning for it. It made us feel, you know, very on brand, you know, and there's nothing better than pumping the tires, the Why Hockey brand.
I agree, and just to be, you know, considered and be one of the shows that people listen to of the many Florida Panthers shows that do a good job, I think is, you know, that's all I really, the only goal is, besides just making me happy and giving me something to do with my time and us something to
well,
do with
I mean,
time.
We always have an itch to scratch, and for me, I like doing podcasts, yeah. And it looks good on a resume, and people can say, hey, you're doing somewhat insightful talk about a hockey team that nobody talks about all that much, although yeah. More lately.
We'll see how insightful it is today.
I think it's going to be insightful because I do want to talk about where they are, because since they've done that show, they've actually not played all that well. And some of it's tied to Aaron Ekblad being out of the lineup. Some of it is tied to, at some point, they were going to play poorly because from the end of December until the beginning of March, they were playing at an incredibly ridiculous clip, other than one other little blip in mid-January. So at some point they were going to struggle again because it's an 82-game NHL season. This will happen.
Yeah, but I see. Here's the thing. I think we're getting into the problem of doing is there always has to be a reason. There has to be an explanation. There's some people who have to boil it down to like, oh, everyone needs to settle down because we're finally good and imagine how bad we are, or you know, it's an 82-game season. They couldn't always win. I mean, they always fall. There's always these truisms or things that people have to fall back on, even to not make a statement. There's a statement made and not even making a statement. And I think that especially this time of year, for a team like the Florida Panthers, the best thing to do is to go outside, touch grass, and not say anything. And this comes from somebody who talks way too much, especially about hockey. But it's always with an intent and a purpose, even if that intent and purpose is just to try to fake the idea of control over a situation when the franchise seems out of control back in the day. But, you know, the thing is, this team now is doing intentful things. There is a plan, there's a strategy, there's a purpose. And it's pretty easy to line up. And you have a coach who's framing things for the media pretty well. I mean, everyone talks about how Maurice gives so much time to the media, is so well-spoken, and puts things in ways everybody can understand. And if you look at the pressers, he's been consistent. He hasn't been the same. He's been consistent in what the messages inside that locker room, what they're working on, how they're going to fix it, and then you can see it start to improve on the ice. So what are we talking about? What's the purpose of all of this talk other than working out the nervous, anxious energy? Because there's no trades they can make. We're just waiting to see who we match up with in round one, and that helpless feeling of just waiting is something I think this fan base is only getting used to or only starting to experience now, with the expectations of being good, with having their path set earlier in the season than they ever have than they usually, you know, ever do. And I think it's just a learning curve, but the best thing to do is to honestly not say anything.
Let's go over this for a second, because I think your point is well taken. Firstly, a couple years ago, the run was so fun, and they had that 13-game winning streak towards the end of the season that you weren't actually thinking about playoff improvements in that way, and because the season was so unique and so special.
Right.
Although it got lost in the shuffle when eventually they did go to the playoffs.
See, this is what I'm talking about, is I can play devil's advocate and whittle away any of these arguments. That 13-game win streak is great, but they went into the playoffs getting smoked by Montreal.
It's true.
And falling apart on the bench. Brunette doesn't change the goalie, doesn't pull the goalie to send a signal. Doesn't, you know, he just kind of lets it happen, is like, oh, whatever, last game of this. You know, there's so much you can talk about, and you can always say, and that's why these Twitter discourses are so stupid, because someone's only giving one nugget or one talking point at a time, and that one talking point then becomes the entirety of the discussion. And if you blow it up and focus on that, you can come at it from every different angle and say, you know, if someone says, you know, look at this, this is onside or this is offside, you can always say, well, look at this other thing, you know, the what about kind of stuff. But if you pull it back and do the big picture and you want to have a full conversation about this, I think it boils down to the team's working as expected. The team is framing things and seems to be handling this well. We know they handle resiliency well. We know they believe in themselves well, and we know that they put in the work. So what are we what are we worrying about? What are we talking about? Let's just let it happen. Let's just wait till the playoffs.
I think there's a couple parts of that. Your first point is well taken about how, you know, the fan base that's very online, which isn't representative necessarily of the larger fan base that does not spend its day on a website owned by right. Elon Musk.
But, I mean, and it's not just Philadelphia. It's not just Florida. It's not just Philadelphia. It's not just big markets. It's not just small markets. It's not just new teams to winning or teams that have always won and under tons of pressure, like, you know, the Lightning now or the Maple Leafs and the Habs and all of that stuff who've won before.
This is Twitter. But I also want to make the point that you can get under a little analysis paralysis this time of year, and it's okay. As you said, there's no trade deadline anymore. It's passed. For teams like the Panthers, when you see other teams around you because the President's Trophy race is so close, you see other teams winning and you start to get a little antsy. You lose a game like you lose to Boston, and you get a little antsy. The other point that I'm going to make, and I have unfortunate experience with this, with certain team called Tottenham Hotspur, which I'm not going to spend too much time talking about that, because I know how much it winds you up, is that, and I'm not accusing any individual of doing this, I'm saying people do this on the whole on social media, and it happens a lot worse in other places than it does with this Panthers Twitter or Panthers Blue Sky. I don't think anybody talks about the Panthers on Blue Sky. I would know, because I'm there. I think some people, unfortunately, try to be doomer and try to be, you know, fatalistic for clout, because then it gets followers and it gets people to their tweets and it gets engagement. Like, that has definitely happened.
Yeah.
This will continue to happen for the rest of time. It's unfortunate, but it's the way the world works. And I even heard Elliot Friedman mention it on a recent 32 Thoughts podcast. It's like, this is how fans act. And it's true. It's how fans act.
Like, for me, it's not just, it's this, I mean, I think two things get a lot of clicks: dunking on somebody and hating, being a hater and dunking on somebody. And that is the ESPN First Take-ification of all sports, but mainly just the sports dialogue, where sports teams are just a regular season game goal. It's like the winning the Stanley Cup with the way that social media admins like try to dunk on each other and post, you know, the memes with the L's and all this and take the L and, you know, using all that stupid like web chat talk. And you know, it's just like, that's just what it keeps devolving more and more into. And with how strong fandoms are and how strong that, you know, that kind of modus operandi is with these fans and how they talk, it's all we're going to get.
Like, so let's talk about the actual hockey now that we have a chance
to. Let's talk about the hockey.
So they're 1-4-1 in their last six. They have some issues, clearly, because Aaron Ekblad is hurt.
This is what I'm – but what's the issue?
Like, to me – I'll go over some things that I think are a little concerning. I'm not going to go crazy on this, but I'll go with some things that are a little concerning. I think, and they've had more injuries recently, player absences, than they've had at other times.
But are they injuries, or are they just being, like, a lot of people are banged up. I mean, we know why Ekblad's banged up and everything, and Forsling and Barkov and stuff.
They've been extra cautious with them, which is the right thing to
like,
do.
Yeah, like, is that an issue?
No, I'm talking about on-ice play and some things that I see that I think they need to address before we get to the playoffs.
Are they going to be there in the playoffs?
Will they? The issues, at least.
Well, yeah, will they? Because, I mean, people keep talking about issues and stuff, but nobody has been able to actually word or phrase what an issue is that and why it could still be there come the playoffs. Because all the issues I've been told are basically, you can say, well, when they get healthy and the D pairs are the top six, I don't see those issues continuing.
I think what I've seen in some games recently is, I talked about the late goals, and yes, the Boston goals were, you know, some of it's bad luck. You know, one of it is Evan Rodriguez throws the puck over the glass. Okay. Another is you don't clear the zone on the Zacha goal. You got to get the puck out there. My point has been that I've seen some late goals. You know, the Flyers game that we talked about when we did the trade deadline show, like, you give up a goal with 18 seconds left. Like, again, those are not good goals to give up.
Who's on the ice in those minutes that would not be on the ice in those minutes in the playoffs?
I don't think that it's about who's on the ice necessarily.
I'm not seeing breakdowns. I'm not seeing a team that is losing focus. I'm seeing a team that is reworking and rejiggering and getting people who haven't played a lot of hockey to start playing reps. And while they're doing so, they're getting told to play 100% all out. It would be a lot prettier defensively if Mahora and Belinsky and all this, they were told, hey, just hang back. You don't have to jump. But that's not what they're being told to do. They're being told to play the system as it's being constructed to play, knowing that there's going to be some weak points. There's going to be some gaffes and mistakes until they get back up to speed. But long term, that's the best way to do it. That's what I see on the ice. And yeah, in the beginning, it's like, yeah, well, if Mahor is not going to, you know, step up and figure it out quickly, then you got to look to somebody else. But guess what? He has stepped up and he's getting better with more and more reps. And it's not because he's dialing back his game. It's just because he's been told to play the same way and being given support and being given opportunities by Maurice right now to work his way through it.
I think what I would be saying is, like, we talked for those, like, almost 3 months when their game was pretty much impeccable, other than a couple of blips. Like, what would cause their game to start to break down a little bit? Like, every team, as you have said, is going to have stretches where their game breaks down a tiny bit, and you're not perfect. So what would then cause the Panthers for their games to, I mean, you could say absences, but beyond that, what else would cause their game to break down a little bit to the point where you have to build it back up again, which is what they're doing right now?
Like, again, and people are going to run with this in the wrong way, like they run with a lot of things on the internet the wrong way, but like, they are bringing in new people, and new as in people who haven't been here or haven't played in a while, or people who are actually new to the organization, like Okposo and Tarasenko. So now you're bringing people in, and it's not just about bringing them in, but it's okay, now, you know, you're trying them with different lines, you're moving things because you want to try to get as many data points on this player, so when in the playoffs, this new player, you feel confident in, I know how to leverage and utilize this player to get the most out of them. I know what they can do, I know what they can't do, and I know what they can give me. And you know, that comes at a cost. I think Maurice has been very specific about the cost. I think he's been very real with the fan base about what they're trying to do and what their focus are. And if you asked him, the game is getting better, not getting worse.
I would say the last three games, they've definitely gotten better.
That they
There's
were
no
playing
doubt about
worse
that.
Hockey and winning games than they were playing hockey and losing games. And I think that, like, again, what is the goal? The goal is to win the Stanley Cup. The goal is not to be first in the division. The goal is not to win the game in front of you. The goal is to win the Stanley Cup. And we've talked about all year about how they need to work through the season towards that goal. And we talked about how it would have been nice if they played and got Mahora and, you know, some of these guys, Lawrence and all these guys, more reps so that they, you know, they don't have to go through these growing pains at the end of the season. But they didn't. And you can't go back and change time. And if you probably talked to Maurice, he'd probably convince you it was the right thing to do, because he would have said, listen, we had injuries early in the year. We came out of camp with a strong bottom, with a strong group, and we were running with it to build up that lead. And we knew we could take a little bit of a step back in the spring to get the new people acclimated, to get guys some reps again and everything. But we needed to get the job done first. And are you going to argue with, like, I mean, this is what I'm saying. Like, I don't understand. They're not playing that bad of hockey. They played bad hockey for a couple games. Maurice said they were playing bad hockey and they started playing better. Isn't that what we've been dying to see from any other coach? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills where I'm the voice of reason. Maybe it's the contrarian nature where everybody's going crazy, so I'm now reasonable. But like, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills because there isn't anything of note worth saying. Like, I mean, other than like, I like this, I don't like this, this, you know, like it'd be nice if they were winning, or, oh man, that wasn't a penalty and stuff like that. Yeah, like enjoy the games and stuff. But I don't think there's any big point to make or intelligent insight to that Maurice isn't already spoon feeding you.
I can see the argument you're making because clearly in the last three games, they've played much better. I mean, the Flyers game, you can almost kind of throw that out because they had no energy, but they found a way to win. And it was interesting. He made the comment, I think it was, I don't remember what game it was, but he was basically like, we didn't learn anything from the Dallas game, the crazy comeback, because they played poorly and they found a way to win. But like, that was in some ways the canary in the coal mine, because then in the other games that followed that, they played poorly and lost. But then against the Rangers with everybody out, all those players unavailable, they played a much better game and they almost won. And then against the Bruins, they had a couple of breakdowns late, but they did play the style they wanted to play, and they were dictating the terms of that game for most of it. So I think whatever they had been going through for at least a little while, I think they've turned out of it. And also, we have to say, the schedule since the, you know, trade deadline was concluded was pretty difficult, and you're playing a lot of teams who are in really good form right now. So even the Panthers, as good as they are not going to beat everybody. And for me, a couple little defensive breakdowns. I think at times the penalty killed. They have been giving up some goals there. But as you said, I think they're all fixable. I've never said that these issues are not fixable.
But like, would you say that they're probably getting fixed?
I would like to see the evidence of them getting fixed, but I have no reason to believe they won't.
Isn't the improving play the evidence?
Yeah, I would say, like, on the penalty kill, like, they have given up a power play goal in, like, five or six straight games, or, like, six out of seven.
Yeah, so, like, but you're going to, I mean, get, when the, when they, when you give up 4 to 5 power plays in a game, you're going to give up one goal a game. Like, that's just pretty much this, it's the NHL. They, guys know how to score nowadays. Like, it's hard to stop teams from scoring at all. They're going to score a little, the you know, but if you can control the power play so it's not automatic, I think that's where it needs to be. And again, they just got Barkov back. Barkov was obviously playing banged up for the last couple games of that poor play and then was out. And that is pretty much the penalty kill right there.
in many ways, I would say that certainly having him back and the power play too, like that. Yeah. That's,
I mean, between Ekblad and Barkov, that is at one point they had their three most impactful defensive players out of the lineup.
Oh, for the Rangers game, they certainly did. Yes.
I don't know. Like, there, again, to me, there's like, yeah, you can say like, oh, there's some, you can go over video and say, this is was good, this was bad, and they can learn from it and improve and everything. But there's no reason to think that isn't happening. And there's no reason for us fans who don't have the ability to go into that detail for this kind of stuff to do it on the general things. If we're looking at the general long picture, this is, you have to feel like this is the best you're going into the playoffs. You have a mix of the brains, you have a mix of the bronze, you've earned your keep playing playoff hockey, but you've won a lot of games, you scored a lot of goals, you have a good power play. So, I mean, I don't know. Like, it seems like the locker room's calm, cool, and collected, that they're like a well-oiled machine, and when the coach says something, it might take a game or a period or whatever, but they get it and you see it on the ice. Personally, for me, this, I'm the most excited. And when I'm excited about hockey and stuff, it's like, I don't know, game face goes on, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't expect the players in the locker room to start falling apart because of the way they're playing. I expect them to instead say, you know, all we have to do is recommit to the system. All we have to do is recommit to working hard. All we have to do is recommit to keeping our head down. Like, so if that's the message in the locker room, that it's like in the Boston series, when fans were able, when the message was just get it back to Florida in the locker room, the fans molded to that. And that was what I think that helped all of our collective psyche so we could enjoy the Boston series and everything that came after, because we had that same mentality. Well, it doesn't change this year, I don't think. I think you have to have that same mentality of that belief in the locker room and everything, because if anything this year, they've shown through the Montour and Ekblad injuries, through this, through the trade deadline acquisitions and stuff, their goalie tandem's going strong. I mean, all the little squares are firing, and you know, just make all the pieces are, you know, great, are adding up to a pretty big, I don't know how to say this.
They're adding up to be, mix is working.
Some is greater than its parts, but you know.
Yeah, the mix is working pretty well, and I don't worry that, as you say, that they're having a blip, because every team's going to have one. It just happens that this is happening right now. As long as it doesn't happen in a month, that's pretty much
like,
what
I mean,
ask for.
To me, like, the conversations that you that are going to be that, like, I can't stop or whatever, because until it's borne out, you can, excuse me, debate it back and forth, which is the trade deadline moves. For me, I have no problem with them. I would have loved to get a right-handed defenseman, but if you're, but most likely that means no Toby Bjornfoot, which I would have just, you know, I'm fine with what they did. Tarasenko has, I don't want to hear anybody say that wasn't the right move. It came at almost no cost. Every game, there's been multiple forechecks. He's started with a big hit. There's been back checks that he's been the first forward back when he didn't have to be, but he beat another forward back because he was skating harder than them. That type of stuff shows you that this was the right fit. This was the right trade. Whether it works out or not, I don't think that you can Monday quarterback this one into a negative. I just don't. You can see the chemistry that he has with a few different players on the team. And I don't know. Okposo, I can't see how that could ever hurt. You know, he's not, they don't seem to feel the need to have to play him. And he seems to, in everything he said, he seems to understand what his role is. And in his time on ice, he hasn't been bad. So
I think both trades have been fine. Like, correlation's not causation. The fact that the Panthers are losing a little after the trade deadline does not mean trade deadline acquisitions were bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and they were like, winning.
The Panthers had a 13-game winning streak after they added all of those players in 2022. Like, correlation's not causation.
Yeah. And again, I don't. Did they lose in the President's Trophy year because of the trade deadline moves? No. Were the trade deadline moves necessary in hindsight or at the time? No, but that doesn't mean that they lost because of the moves. They lost because of their inexperience and their coaching, and just they didn't get the job done. But that's a different. I think they're going to get the job done this year.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to win the cup. I don't know if they're going to win the cup, but I don't think that we're going to be looking at the Florida Panthers and wondering if they didn't get the job done. I mean, knock on wood.
Let's talk about a couple of individual things that we should focus on. Just little discussions that we can have that are things we should, you know, have eyes on going forward. And it's Y Hockey, so we're going to talk about the defensemen. With Ekblad out and them being extra cautious with him, you've seen Mahura and Balinskas and one game Bjornfoot play. And while your sixth defenseman is not necessarily going to be the difference between you winning the Stanley Cup and not, there is a discussion about whether Balinskas or Kulikov should be in the lineup, or even Bjornfoot, who I thought played well against the Rangers. And it's an interesting discussion to have. And Balinskas, I think, since he's come back into the lineup, has been really quite good. And you now have to have a discussion.
I don't think you do. I think the discussion has already been had with the coach in the media, and he's already said what the answer is. And because of what the answer and his reasoning is, it won't change. So for me, Kulikov is six, Belinsky or Mahura is set. I think the conversation is who's seventh? Who's the first one in if Kulikov or somebody else goes down? Or if Kulikov has like a couple bad games or whatever. But to me, the debate has pretty much been handled. I think it's known if Maurice is going to be putting a left-hander on the right side for that pair, it's going to be third pair. It's going to be Kulikov because he uses the offside to leverage his physicality, and that's something that those two players aren't able to do. And plus just having the experience. Maurice is in the playoffs is going to go with familiarity as the best fit, for sure.
I agree with you 100%. Like, the evidence was that once everyone was healthy, that Kulikov was going to be the sixth.
In my opinion, I think that it comes to matchup. I could play both of them, and I probably would play both of them in a series or between two series, depending on a matchup or how the series was going or performance and that stuff. I think it's equal. But I'm totally, like, Maurice is saying this is what he's doing, his reasoning, and how he's going to act. And he's saying this is how they got to the decor in the summer and everything like that and to start the year, and it's worked. So I'm not going to challenge it, at least until it stops working. If it doesn't work in the playoffs and everything, yeah, we can have that conversation then. And I think that's kind of where we're at. We're at a point where we're in purgatory, you know, and unless they start playing like crap, you know, really playing like crap, then I think we're just kind of waiting. For me though, like, for me, it's like, is Montour's doing pretty well, and I liked him with Forsling. Is that a possibility in the playoffs that we see a Montour Forsling?
It's interesting because this was a pair you advocated for last year, and we never saw it. I mean, maybe we saw it in very, very brief fits and spurts, but we never really saw it. So if you go back and listen to our shows from last year, I know you advocated for that. And obviously very different defense corps. I think that, again, maybe in a situation where you really need to drive offense, like, it's one of those games where you've got one goal, you really need to drive to create something more. There needs to be more. I'm not saying that all that Ekblad and Mikkola aren't aggressive, because they are. But, like, if you really wanted to go all out and generate offense in a certain way, like, I think that pairing could work. But until we see evidence that they need to change what they've gone with since Ekblad and Montour have been healthy, I don't think you're going to see a ton of change in that regard, because there has been, you know, we were surprised when they got everybody back that these were the pairings that they were going to put together, and they've largely worked. Like, there's been very little wrong with them when they're going at full tilt.
They work, but, I mean, again, when it comes to the playoffs, it's a different beast. So it's what are you trying to accomplish and do? So I agree with what you're saying as far as, you know, if you're trying to push offense a certain way, you'd want Forsling and Montour together. But I think, like, you know, the Mikkola-Montour pairing, if I was an opposing coach, I would rather Montour play with Mikkola than Forsling. It's a lot easier for me to target a pair like Montour and Mikkola than Forsling and Montour. And if I'm somebody who's looking at trying to figure out whose corner I'm dumping it into, who I'm hitting, who I'm trying to get off the game, Montour is probably the first defenseman that comes to mind. I say this because Forsling, I think, is somebody that they is understood that he's just, you know, a quiet tank. You might not hear much about him, but you're not going to get him to play his game different. He's consistent. He's tough. He's going to grit it out. He is what he is. There's things you can attack on him, but you kind of know that. And, you know, with Montour, there's just so much roller coaster to his game. There's so much ups and downs. There's so much gamble and risk that you might lose, but that's a good one to target, because if you can get him off his game, then all of a sudden you're winning the lottery, because he keeps losing and he's going to probably double down to make it up. Ekblad is somebody, I think, who's shown in the last couple of years, he's really matured his game and turned it into somebody who's pretty pivotal in the defense we've seen. And I think is, when you talk about what Florida needs to do in the playoffs, Ekblad is going to be the biggest part and is the example of what that's going to be. It's going to be somebody who's going to be committed to playing defense first, is going to be vicious in front of the net and in the corners. And for Florida, that's Ekblad. And I think, you know, teams will try to get him off a certain way. But I don't think a matchup is going to change how teams target those guys. A matchup will change how a team targets Montour, because the wrong partner or not the best partner is going to leave Montour on an island more, which means he's going to be more vulnerable with the way he plays.
So if you were to put Forsling and Montour together when everybody's healthy, how would you structure the rest of the defense?
It's a good question. I mean, there's different ways. I mean, if we're, you know, like, let's say we're going against Toronto, you know, just use
which,
that as
again,
an example.
It might not end up being Toronto, but right now, if it ended today, it would be Toronto.
Well, Florida would have to make up a game first, and then,
well, yeah,
see,
I mean,
they won or
it's
lost.
It's useless to say as if it was recording today, yeah, but who cares?
But, you know, like, I think if you have a Mikkola-Ekblad pairing and you use them for defensive minutes and you give them that, it would work. Now there's I would target them side to side, and I think you could, you know, that four-way mobility is not as strong.
And against Toronto, you know, they do a lot of east-west trying to generate that look, right?
That's not something that would scare me away from it. I think, you know, that's something that you just prepare the D4 and you have them step up and rise to the challenge, because there's always going to be something. You know, there's no, you know, Scott Niedermeyer and Chris Pronger are not on that back end. That's the perfect pairing, and you're not going to get that. So there's always going to be something. So you don't want to, you know, get too in your head about having the perfect pairing. But I also like OEL and Ekblad. I think personally, OEL is the type of person that might be able to get Ekblad playing a little more with better timing and a little more with some intel, a little more, a little less kind of brain off moments. You know, so I could see that as a good pairing. I think that you have to build your top four and kind of go from there, because your top four is going to be facing the biggest minutes. They're going to be playing 45 minutes a game, maybe even 50 some games. So, you know, you can put your fifth and sixth best defensemen together on the third pair, and it might not be the best fit, but you might lose more taking someone out of the top four onto that third pair to make that third pair a little better. I don't, that's not necessarily what I would do. I think you got to say, these are the two best pairings we can have, and that we can probably run 50 minutes a night if we need to. And then I trust the third pair is going to be good enough where I won't have to run them 50 minutes a night. So that's what I would try to aim for. You know, Kulikov Mikula as a third pairing in sheltered, you know, in the lower minutes and stuff, I think in the playoffs isn't going to be brutal. And if it is, you have pairings you can switch to.
And you have players you can bring in if you have to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if they're going to get the reps down the stretch, I think that they're artificially keeping Ekblad out to continue to give some defensemen who aren't playing more reps.
And let's be honest, like, we have been advocating for that for a long time. Like, if you are nicked up, don't play. Yes.
And it's finally happening. And people are like, oh, Barkov's so soft. And like, I just want to reach into the computer and slap someone, you know?
Like this is the way to do it. If these guys are even mildly nicked up, this isn't last year where you had to win every game to get in. You're already in no matter where you finish. And it is highly unlikely at this stage that they will not have home ice in the first round at the very least. So you can afford to keep guys out for a little longer than you would otherwise to rotate and give them minutes, and it's what we've been advocating for, and they're doing it, and I'm glad they're doing it because...
Well, I don't even look at it of like, they can afford to or not. I think the mentality is we have the guys in the room where we can be rotating in and still beat anybody. That, and I think that's the mentality you want to have. We can make sure that we stay healthy. We have a team where next guy up isn't just something you put on the wall. It's something that you expect and will get done. And I think that's the mentality you should advocate more for than thinking that it's, oh, Zito and Maurice are okay with losing points. They're not okay with losing points. It's not like they're scheduling a loss. They're advocating for, we have more than enough talent in our depth to keep winning and to play the game we want to play. And as long as our game and the process is good, we're going to keep doing this.
No, I think the process has been a lot better in recent games. And if you continue to see that, that's going to be the big tell when it comes to the playoffs. Just quickly on the lines for a second, with Barkov back, they tried something a little different with Rodriguez and Tarasenko, and they kept Reinhart with Lundell and Lostarainen. We've talked a lot about lines and how they're multiple. Yeah. They can do a lot of different things, a lot of different looks, and they're trying this out now. And Paul Maurice said when you put Reinhart back with Lundell and Lostarainen, and some of it was out of necessity because of Barkov being out, but also, like, that's a line he can go to, and he, you know, he trusts it because he did last year in really key minutes. What do you think about the group that you're seeing out there in the top nine? Like, in the bottom six, you could rotate in whoever. Like, Lawrence is playing pretty well right now, so he's hard to get out of the lineup. which we didn't necessarily expect earlier in the year. But on the top nine, like, is this what you want to run with, or do you want to see Reinhart back with Barkov? Or
I don't know if Lawrence is hard to get out of the lineup. I think it's kind of like I said with some of the defensemen. They're creating the opportunity for reps. They want to create a little more of that competition. They want to keep guys in it more. And Lawrence is having has had a terrible year in my estimation. I shouldn't say terrible, under my expectation of what he'd bring this year so far, until he got back into the lineup. So I think that they're rewarding him, saying you worked hard all year, you weren't playing, now you are playing, and you're playing good. You played good as a center. We'll keep you as a wing next night and stuff. I like that. I don't think he's going to be hard to keep to get out of the lineup come playoff time. I think that's going to be like the first thing. I think they've probably already been like, whoop, you know, in the mind, he's already yanked. But you never know. You never know. For the top nine, for me, there's pros and cons. You see the cons of having like Rodriguez on the first line with Barkov. You're going to get stupid penalties late. You're going to get, there's some times where his inability to finish a play, not just finish a puck into the net, but finish a play, because he's a smart player, but when it comes to finishing offense, that's kind of like where he's like a C student. And that could cost them. You know, and there could be points where you could say if Reinhart was in that spot, he would have scored. Just like there's probably going to be a time where Lofgren or Lundell get a playoff goal, and you can be like, well, Reinhart made that goal happen. If he wasn't there, maybe it's a goal against on that third line. So there's gives and takes. It's basically, does he think he can get the same out of Reinhart while getting more out of Lofgren and Lundell, and having three lines gives him more of an advantage in a series versus what do you lose in goals by taking Reinhart off that Barkov line? Because you will lose goals. You could have Verhaeghe, Tarasenko up there, but the way that this year is going and the form that Reinhart and Barkov are on together, you will lose goals by not having Reinhart, at least with Tkachuk, who also has great chemistry with him this year. So that's but that doesn't mean it's wrong. I mean, listen, there's a lot of people who would say Yeri Lehtinen on a first line, or Mikael Renberg on a first line, or Zach Hyman on a first line isn't ideal. But it's ideal if you can make it work. And that's the key. And I think it's with Tarasenko, Rodriguez had that plays better. Erod, I think with Erod on the first line allows you to slide Reinhart down. You still have Tarasenko. You put him on his off wing. There's a lot of benefits to that. It's a different discussion than earlier in the year when it was, is Rodriguez or Verhaeghe better on a left wing with Barkov and Reinhart, which is a totally different conversation.
And this is what adding Tarasenko does to your lineup. And by the way, I know he's only scored three goals. I understand that. But look, there were a couple games where he wasn't, like, he was playing with Stephen Lawrence as a center. I don't judge Tarasenko based on his performances when he's not with Barkov at this point. Because I think that right now, we always talk about with Paul Maurice for the last 2 years, pairs. Like, Bennett and Tkachuk never get broken up. Lundell and Lofgren very often don't get broken up. For a lot of the year, it was Barkov and Reinhart didn't get broken up. But now I think for the time being, it's Barkov and Tarasenko aren't going to get broken up. And then you build out from there. When you need to change the pairings, whether it be through injury, whether it be through the additions, as we've talked about, whether it be through, you know, performance, which could happen at some point. Like, we saw it after game one of last year's series against Boston. He changed everything and it worked. You know, that's when the pairs change. But for right now, I think those are your pairings. And if you have three lines that you know you can trust to throw in those situations against whoever you're facing, like, when, like, think about it, if it's Boston who they're going to play in the playoffs at some point, like, I'd take Florida's top nine, particularly because of the centers, but you can throw whatever look you want out there. And I think last night they were better even strength than Boston, those top three lines. Against Toronto, at some point there is a drop-off in that lineup. And if it's Lundell, Osterain, and Reinhart, we saw what happened last year in the playoffs where the Panthers had three lines that were running. And at some point, that third line ended up, you know, being the difference in that series. So, and Tampa, if they play Tampa, there is a drop-off in that lineup too. Whereas when you're going from a Barkov line as currently constructed to Bennett, Tkachuk, and Verhaeghe to then Lundell, Osterain, and Reinhart, he can flatten out the minutes too. Like, he trusts them all in difficult minutes when he needs to put them out there. Like, he's got no qualms putting that quote-unquote third line out there in defensive minutes if he has to, but you know it's going to generate offense, right? Also want to say, like, and I think we have to say, that Sam Reinhart getting 51 and having a legitimate chance to become the single-season record holder for goal scoring for the Panthers, I don't think any of us saw that coming, and I understand the shooting percentage argument. Yes, you're not going to shoot 26%, but if you listen to Dmitry Filipovich and Daryl Belfry talking about Reinhart, just like they talked about Barkov earlier the year, highly recommend you listen to that show. It's only 49 minutes. Please go do it. Talking about Reinhart's incredible ability to make it work with whoever he's playing with and the level he can play at, like, there's a reason why he's really good with Barkov right now. Like, that's going to happen at some point. Like, he was going to break out, and he really has. And I think the goal he scored against the Bruins, it just... there's very few players in the league that know how to get into quiet ice better than he does. And that's what impresses me every single time. It's just, he knows where to be, and he's 2 seconds ahead of where the defense has to know where to be, and that's why he could score all those goals, because he just gets into better positions than everybody else, because he's smarter than everybody else, pretty much. It's incredible to watch, and I'm so happy for him. And it's going to be very funny when he signs a contract that's slightly below or equivalent to Matthew Tkachuk, when on the open market, some other team would pay him $2 million
more. I personally would not sign a contract that is equal to Matthew Tkachuk for Sam Reinhart, point blank, period. I don't care if you can prove to me he's this player, that he's going to repeat 50 goals every year. I still wouldn't do it.
Well, I understand that. I necessarily wouldn't either, but
yeah, but
you know what I mean.
8.5, 8.75.
But he's having a truly incredible season, and we have to celebrate that.
Yeah, I agree. And there's tons of context for it. It doesn't matter if he's a 35-goal scorer who's having the best career year he'll ever have, and he'll go back to 35 or 38 or 40 next year, whatever. Doesn't matter if it, a lot of it's off that power play. It doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, this isn't Jonathan Chichu. This is like, and nothing to put anything on Jonathan Chichu's name. He still did it. I still would love to be Jonathan Chichu. And I think that's what, like, a lot of people don't understand is, like, just enjoy it. Like, you, if other people want to say Sam Reinhart, whatever, he's not that good, whatever, they can. Who cares? Because Sam Reinhart is showing to a new generation that doesn't think playing defense first hockey means you can put up 50 goals. Doesn't think that, you know, being really good at everything and very smart and being a student of the game will get you just as far as being flashy and super skilled and having all the crazy moves and stuff. And for me, that's what I like about it. I've always liked the guys who play team first, defense first. And for me, 50-goal seasons are like kind of the stereotype that is the opposite of that. So for him to do that with this team, our team, that's trying to show that defense first has a and playoff style hockey all the time has a place in this new NHL. I love it. I could get into that narrative all day. And that is probably the biggest reason I wouldn't want to break up Reinhart and Barkov, is because this form from Reinhart, you're not going to get. And yes, you could utilize that to make the third line better. But with him and Barkov, who are just in crazy intelligent together, what could you do? What could you do?
Well, you get the goals you got against the Rangers in that game earlier in March, which were just insane. Like, you don't get other... Like, I don't think you could get goals like that from anybody else on the ice. It's because... Not that the players that the Panthers have aren't intelligent. I think they are. But then there's another level of sometimes hockey sense where just these two see the game in a way that just few others do.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're all NHL players. They're all smart. They're all NHL players that can all wire a puck. But, you know, we still say that there's some guys who are just that much better at shooting pucks than the others. Similar with thinking the game and understanding. I mean, Reinhart can play any position, and he can jump in and play center on the third line, jump right back up.
He takes defensive zone face-offs with 2 minutes to go protecting the lead.
Yeah, I mean, I really hope Zito can get this to work. I really hope they can come together and find like that 8-year, 8.75 cap hit deal and get it done. Maybe even a little less, you know, would be nice. See if they can keep him and Forsling and even get Montour back and stuff, because I think this is the type of core you do want to keep together.
Now, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And Reinhardt's...
Reinhart was worth that amount of money when he came here and his first two seasons were pretty good. You know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't want to overdo it, but I mean, like, it's just simple fact is that he is third or fourth most important forward on the team.
It's incredible to have your 50-goal scorer be your third or fourth most important forward on the team, but that's a sign of a well-constructed team, you know?
Yeah, and that's why you want to keep them together, because you're not... I don't think you win Sam Reinhardt leaving.
No, you don't. No. Because you can't replace something like that easily.
Yeah. But, you know, that's the Panthers, and I'm just excited to see it happen. I really just want to be a fan through this for the most part.
Should we talk about another 50-goal scorer since we're talking about 50-goal scorers?
Yeah, so I want to talk about... So the Andrew Berkshire...
I love Andrew. He's done a lot of great work. I felt so bad what happened with Game Over. He's a wonderful person. Wonderful human
being. And this is not going to be really about anything other than the loss of nuance and media literacy and anything like that. I don't agree with either of the polematic sides that are basically just been trying to prove each other are the scum of the earth. I've literally seen people say that someone saying that Andrew saying this is scum of the earth. And I've seen people who say, you know, dunking on Andrew for this makes them everything devolves into that. But here's what I'll say. There is a lot of nuance lost here. Nobody is saying Zach Hyman isn't a hard worker. I actually listened to the video, and it's mentioned multiple times that Andrew Berkshire thinks he's one of the hardest workers in the NHL. I don't think this has anything to do with an international... I don't even know how to say this because people are so passionate on both sides, you could say. But like, people are attributing this to Zach Hyman being Jewish and this being anti-Semitic because of Berkshire's positions on other topics. I don't think this has to do anything with that either.
I don't understand how the two are related in any... Like, again, I have not watched the video, but I don't know how they'd be related. Like, what's the point here?
I think what a lot of people are missing is this is getting glossed over of Zach Hyman is wealthy, and therefore he can't be a hard worker. That is not what is being said. It's not even that Zach Hyman's wealthy. And this is just the argument that's being made. I think everybody in this just is stupid, because I think everybody has good points, and everybody also is really showing their ass on this too. But not every wealthy... Mike Comrie, extremely wealthy. Not just from marrying Hillary Duff, not just from playing hockey. Oil money, wealthy. Natural energy, wealthy. lots of people in hockey are wealthy. Former players are wealthy. Former players' kids are wealthy and obviously have connected and privilege, and we know all about that. And it gets brought up all the time when it comes to Sam Reinhart and Willie Nylander and stuff.
I mean, Matthew and Brady Tkachuk.
But, like, what I don't think people realize that Zach, it's not about Zach Hyman's wealth or his parents' wealth. It's about how they leverage that wealth very uniquely where other wealthy parents haven't. We've heard about wealthy parents buying ice time for their kids or owning an ice hockey rink or being able to get trainers or, you know, having pro connections and getting the best of the best to train their kids and stuff. Zach Hyman's dad bought like dozens of hockey teams, bought leagues in Canada. When his sons were of age and were getting ready to draft, he bought International Scouting Services, ISS. You don't hear about rich, like, that is something to talk about. That doesn't take away anything from Zach Hyman's journey. I don't know why it has to be brought up because he scored 50 goals. I don't know why it was brought up in the way it was. I don't think it is necessarily a good or bad thing. But I think if people want to equate Zach Hyman with former pros and all these other experiences, I think they should at least know that it was a little different, that this is not a unique thing, that most wealthy parents don't get that involved in buying and investing in their child's hockey career. Literally buying the teams, all the teams he plays for, all the teams he could play for, you know, in the following years, buying the one of the more NHL consulted scouting services and having that sort of ownership over that. You could, and this is where the nuance comes in. You could say that makes it harder for the kid. You could say that it adds more pressure. It's more of a challenge and all of that. So, like, no, this doesn't mean that he scored actually 35 goals because you have to, you know, give him fractional goals because he, you know, had advantages or he had disadvantages or wherever you want to talk about it. But I think to everybody that is just running to dunk and make the stupidest connections and stuff and, like, listen, I have no problem with Zach Hyman other than he leveraged his privilege to not sign with the Florida Panthers. I mean, no, it's very likely that somebody who does not have certain resources and luxuries that Zach Hyman had as a fifth-round pick who only had one good year in a four-year college career – and to turn that into signing with the Toronto Maple Leafs. And most kids would just not Adam Fox it, not Cutter Gauthier it. He was able to do that in a time where fifth-round picks were not able to do that because of his connections. He's not the only person who have ever done that. There's tons of players with former – who have parents who were agents or were former coaches or former minor league players that – were, you know the system and know how to work it to their kids' advantage and all that stuff. But I'll leave it with this last thing because I'm rambling a little bit. I think to help highlight this is everybody knows that there's wealthy kids in hockey and everything. I think, though, it's a little different I don't think people understand that, like, for Zach Hyman, the money allowed him to constantly play and to keep himself having opportunities so his hard work could pay off. There's a lot of people who don't have the resources where the hard work won't be able to pay off because they won't still have opportunities after a while if they don't perform to a certain level, don't show a certain skill set at a certain time. And this is, you know, true of any sport, of any situation. And That's just the way it is. It doesn't mean anybody from any side of the tracks who does accomplish things is less good, less accomplished. And in Formula One, there's richer kids than hockey. There's Lando Norris. Lando Norris's dad is really rich and has used his money to make Lando to help Lando be the best race car driver he can be. And because of that, he's a Formula One driver. There's kids like Lewis Hamilton who came from a very working class background, and his dad scraped and worked multiple jobs to even have his kid be in the conversation of like the junior ranks and stuff. But then there's Lance Stroll, whose dad is super rich and buys teams and has bought in every team in Formula One so his kid can have a seat. And there's people who they're called pay drivers because a sponsor, a company through family connections, or a parent who owns a company pays a team to have the kid drive. That's different than Lando Norris. And whether you want to say Zach Hyman fits one mold versus another, that's all for you to think and all that. But I think that was the conversation going on. I don't know why it needed to be brought up at this time, but the amount of people who were just making the stupidest and laziest references of, oh, Sam Reinhardt's dad played, that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about a very unique case. And this is not the first time it was brought up. And Andrew Berkshire is not the first time it was brought up. When he was drafted by the Panthers, the Toronto Sun, I believe, or Toronto something, did a report on that. And it was literally like the hockey parent who bought an empire for his kid's hockey dreams. That was like the
I mean, one of the rumors at the time, it is unsubstantiated, but one of the rumors at the time was that the Panthers drafted Zach Hyman so that his dad would invest in the team. Like, that was one of the rumors at the time.
Yes, and it's not unique to Zach. You'll hear it again with somebody. And I think what Andrew was just saying is he was tired of it being only cast as, if you work as hard as Zach Hyman, this could be you too. Because Zach Hyman needed all of that hard work and all of those advantages to become a late bloomer who did what he did. I don't know how realistic of a model that is to hold out. And I think there are people who over dramatize and oversell athletes, make athletes more of a role model or more of a, you could follow this example too. When these guys are the percentage of a percentage of a percentage that are at the top of their fields, it's almost silly to try to figure out how they got to where they got to and copy what they did, because your situation is so different, it won't help you.
There was a video. No, you're correct. I 100% agree with you. There is a video. I don't remember which Secret Base John Boy's video it was. There are many that are awesome, where he talks about, you know, being a high school baseball player, and then, you know, it might have been the crazy comeback of the Phillies Pirates, the craziest comeback, whatever. I think it's in that video. But the point I'm trying to make is here. These players that are playing at the professional level are the top, like, 0.01% of people who will ever go out and play this sport, right? And then you're talking about the top, you know, 1% of that is Zach Hyman. Like, yeah, it helps to have institutional advantages, but at some point, you still have to be good, right? This is a very cutthroat business, and there are lots of cutthroat businesses where if you have institutional advantages, it can help you out. I'm well aware of some of them in the field of my choosing, but to say that, you know, Zach Hyman didn't have some institutional advantages is missing the point, because he did, And of course he's a hard worker. If you're going to be a 50-goal scorer in the NHL, if you're going to make the NHL, you have to be a hard worker in some way, shape, or form. Like, is hockey a sport that is dominated by people who are wealthier? In many ways, yes. Does the sport of hockey need to be cheaper to bring more people into this game who should be in this game? Yes, but I don't understand why we're having this discussion around Zach Hyman. I guess because he scored 50 goals and people think he essentially got a golden ticket to score 50 goals. No, he didn't.
I think it's kind of just this purveying cycle we get into where, again, it seems like the internet discourse serves two purposes. To make some big intelligent point, or to dunk on somebody, or to troll on somebody. It'd be, you know, like that's what it only kind of functions as that. So Andrew Berkshire is trying to make a large salient point about hockey using a trending topic on social media as an access point to get viewers and all this stuff. And it didn't work out. He issued an apology and everything like that. It's not the worst thing that he's ever said, probably, and it probably won't be the stupidest thing
he ever said. Hey, you want to talk about somebody who did something stupid on social media and it cost him? Me! I won't go into specifics, but it was me. I did that, and it wasn't that long ago.
I feel like immediately this horse was beat to death, and everybody jumped up, and nobody just even we couldn't even define what was actually being talked about because it got to the point where it was find the least wealthiest player who you can call wealthy and the least connected player you could call connected. Find a clip of them doing something good at hockey and then call them bad at hockey. And it was just a million people doing that. And it was absolutely ridiculous. And here's the thing. Would Zach Hyman be an NHL without his resources? We never know. Would Zach Hyman be an NHL with his resources without his hard work? We never know. It, you know, like, does it matter that his brother didn't become pro? No, it doesn't. Because he might not have had the hard work.
I mean, Sam Reinhart had a brother who was also drafted very highly in the draft, and it didn't work out because that's how this works.
But I mean, like, this, like, the conversation, if you go into individual things, you then only talk about individual cases. And if you're talking about individual cases, the point of, you know, hockey is too expensive or these points of looking at the majority of the hockey population and generalizing it, you can't do. You don't need to do that to prove the point. I think if you're going to talk about Zach Hyman and his experience, it has to be about the fact that is it right for parents to use their money that way, to buy leagues, to buy – I mean, you know, is that okay? Is that not okay? That's the type of conversation you can draw from it. But you can't draw anything around Zach Hyman and his NHL performance based on that. You can just say, is it good for youth hockey? For parents who clearly have NHL intentions for their kids to start buying all the teams just because they can.
Is it good for parents to try to live vicariously through their children's athletic successes?
You can have, like, that's a conversation. I don't know if there's a media, and if there's a media conversation, I don't know if that's a good one because, I mean, what did it do? It created more media confusion and more media coverage of not the thing you were talking about. So
there is a lesson I have learned the hard way, and I will say this from my own personal experiences. When you are trying to get a message across, you can think you are as clear as you can possibly be and put every effort into fine-tuning that message and tweaking it and massaging it to get it out exactly the way you want. But once that message goes into the world, people are going to interpret it differently. You can do everything you want to make sure that the message goes out the way you want to, but some of us, and I'm not saying Andrew hasn't done, you know, incredible work where his message has come across exactly as he wanted it to, there are times when your message gets lost and interpreted differently. And at some point, you know, there's nothing you could do about that. But also, this is social media, where we spent an entire day on Tuesday talking about a bridge collapse and people connecting it to Russian terrorists or something. Well, I don't know. Yeah. Because this is what social media is. So, like, for Andrew, I would say, as somebody who I respect him immensely, like, there are lessons to be taken from all of that. And is the discussion worth having? Yes. Is this the frame of reference to have that discussion? Can be debated.
Also, you have to remember that most people identify themselves as wealthy in the hockey community. So they just see it as a personal attack. And what do hockey players hate more? Personal attacks. And what do? Stick up for themselves the most. And
they, yeah, so you get, there is that
you
too.
You get Ryan Whitney, who, you know, is like, oh, no, I probably came from this type of family, or I'm that family now, and, you know, whatever, and all that stuff. And
I mean, you could, yeah. There are so many different examples, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, who the fuck cares? At some point, like, yeah, like, it just pisses me off because at the end of the day, no one is
Zach Hyman's a 50-goal scorer. You can't reverse that.
Well, no one's talking about the actual issues in hockey. Like, we came out of the GM meetings with no actual fixes to any real problems. We came out with new problems. We didn't fix 3-on-3. We didn't fix the point system. We didn't fix playoff format. We didn't fix the LTIR situation. No, we're gonna make more things challengeable, aka delay and slow down the game more. Fastest game on earth, my ass. And you know, we're gonna, and if it's, we're, because we want to get it right. But if we get it right, but we want to dismiss coaches from doing it because we don't want to delay the game. So if they get it wrong, it's a 5-on-3. Why the fuck are we gamifying this more? Like, what? This isn't some stupid celebrity-sponsored commercial you see on TV for some stupid mobile game you can bet your life away on. This is, like, ridiculous. Like, there's so many problems when you look at the NHL and how it functions as a business, as a marketing arm, as growing the game, as making the game more accessible. Because the biggest hurdle to dwarfing the NBA or any of the other four, and becoming one of the, you know, prominent big four sports, is getting kids to play your game more. How, you know, the learn to play days and everything's good, but you got to go further than that. You got to keep going, and this league doesn't.
You have to offer free ice time at a rink you just happened to open in Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's some stuff, and it's getting better, but. Like, I'm so tired of these media people. Like, the media people are going to be talking about this. Nobody's actually going to do anything about, you know, what was Andrew Berkshire actually trying to say? Does it have any merit? If you don't want to talk about that, fine. Talk about the cost of hockey. Is the cost of hockey too high? You don't want to talk about that? You know, talk about the abuses in youth hockey that are preventing kids from playing the sport. And
I mean, the culture of the sport. I mean, haven't we?
I really want to stop using some of these words that have just become beyond their meaning. It's not like there's abuse in hockey. And there's abuse in a lot of sports. There's abuse in a lot of power institutions because the way we handle things and what we do these days, like, we don't fix problems, we don't have any governance, we don't know how to run things anymore. All we do is know how to help the stockholders, help the investors, whoever.
Buddy, do you need to have a discussion on that one? Cough,
you
media.
Know, like, that's all they really know how to do now. It's just the quarter-to-quarter increases, performances, and budgeting. That's all they know how to do. And other than that, they don't know how to run, you know, and I'm just so sick and tired of it. I'm sick and tired of the commentary on ESPN and how that's affecting all the other media people and the spit and chiclets. And, I mean, you can't even find a well-written game write-up anymore outside of a few examples.
Well, because they're mostly being written by AI.
and it sucks. And they
it
suck.
Does. It very much does.
And eventually people are going to wake up and be like, oh shit, we did have it better. And then they're going to complain, and then they'll be like, oh, why does it suck and all this stuff? Well, it's because you didn't want it. You didn't want to work for it. You didn't want to do the hard things. It's harder to fix LTIR. It's harder to make changes to get parity right, and to have better structured point system. And it takes courage to be like, that playoff format, it had some good things, but like right now we can see why it's not great. Let's make some changes to it. There's obviously a benefits to getting rid of the abuse and the cover-ups. Speaking of that, the Blackhawks had their motion to dismiss denied to get rid of John Doe number 2, a court case against them, which again is not being talked about at all. Obviously, it was talked about the GM meetings behind closed doors, but nobody in the media asked about it. God, no, that would be too much. Instead, you know, let's all make fun of Morgan Riley because he hit somebody after an empty net, and let's all do this and that. And it's, you know, and then they're going to yell at Andrew Berkshire because maybe he misspoke. Maybe he had a stupid opinion. Maybe he didn't say things the right way, or he chose the wrong time to say it, or whatever you want to say. But at least he was trying to do something where there was an intent, and it wasn't just like, I don't know. He was trying to have a real conversation about a real problem in hockey. And at least that part of it, I understand. Not that I take any sides in any of this.
I also want to just point out, because I'm looking at this, and before we end the show, I want to ask you a couple of Flyers questions. Very funny how I was just looking at Instagram story of our good friend Paige, the wonderful Paige Dixon, one of the wonderful human beings who has children right now in minor hockey, and her Instagram story about that. Very interesting, the points. We see parents buy their kids way onto teams constantly. Happens every year, junior A from age 8 to 18. But Hyman took those opportunities and potted 51 goals in the NHL. So kudos to Zach Hyman. I'm like, this happens all the time, basically. I'm like, whether you think it's right or not, like, do I think it's great? No. Is it going to happen? Yes, because people with money will always abuse a system like that. That's humanity,
just like the
unfortunately.
Owner, just like the owners with money will always abuse the system.
Oh, yeah. So, we have to focus on, I think, where are our discussions going and where can we address fundamental flaws and how can we make those systems better so that they're not abused in this way. But even the best systems, people with a lot of money are going to find loopholes and exploit them. That's unfortunately the way it is. Before we end, I want to ask you just briefly, since the Panthers did play the Flyers again, and we often do podcasts after that happens, not that the Flyers, that game was really indicative of anything, but do you want to,
I got something to say.
What would you like to say? Because John Tortorella, the Couturier debate was kind of
exactly.
Silly. But also I wanted to mention, when he, Sandstrom played poorly on Sunday, he didn't say anything, and then he came out 2 days later and admitted that that's probably
three
not
strikes.
The way that he should have done it.
He got three strikes, and he's going to sit his ass down? No way. No way. He's not going to sit himself. Listen, I I've been on this podcast within the last 12 months defending Torts, saying that Torts would have been a good temporary, as in half a year, coach for the Panthers instead of going along with Brunette. I still stand by that. But this is why I didn't want him as a long-term coach, and this is why I think the Flyers giving him too much say in a rebuild is a little ridiculous. So let's start with Coots. Let's go back in time with Coots. Was he playing great? No. Did he deserve to get treated like a lot of the other Flyers and have his ice time reduced and get the tough love treatment from Torts? Absolutely. Absolutely. Was he playing bad enough to get sat? I personally didn't think so. However, some context needs to be applied. Tortorella has kept the C off someone's sweater for so freaking long by a point that when they gave the C to somebody, the assumption was that this person has gone above and beyond to get this C, because Torts was like, the only way I'm giving a C is like in 2026 or whatever. You know, he was, you know, basically saying he never wanted to do it. So to, and he, especially mid season. So to do it mid season and give it to Sean Couturier, and then within 2 weeks, it's a healthy scratch. That just shows so much disharmony. I ask questions. Then you hear Couturier, who has really been a good soldier for the Philadelphia Flyers through a career where they haven't surrounded him with a lot of talent like Claude Giroux.
And he's also been grievously injured at times.
Yeah. This is a kid who, from 18 years old, was defense first, shot block first, take a cross check to the mouth because he's annoying Evgeny Malkin, for the logo on the front type player. So that is something that is like, okay, what is happening? This is not the type of player you make this message of if it's not deserved. And then Couturier's quotes make it seem like he feels he's not being treated equally fairly like the others, that others have, you know, I've been, at least it's implied that it's not, he doesn't understand why he's getting set and others don't, or, you know, why his performance is that bad, and that he feels that the communication between him and Tortorella is a problem. That right there, that's a strike. Whether you think Kutz should have sat or not, whatever, to me, that's the bigger problem. Not the 2 games he sat, and the fact that it may or may not have hurt their playoff chances, or may help their playoff chances. It's this is a team that was saying they're doing things the right way. The communication from the owners all the way down to the locker room is good. This shows that something, from naming a captain to this, something is going wrong with somebody who should be a face and an example of the good communication with Tortorella, who apparently is this culture's face. Strike two. After Felix Sandstrom, who has been a goat to kick by a lot of fans and media members this year, for good reason at points, had a tough game. We all saw it. He probably should have stopped a few. Torts obviously is an emotional guy, and I got a feel for him, because after a coach, as a coach, you hate it when a goalie you don't get saves. Because there's nothing you can do, and there's nothing you can say to a goalie to make him make a save. And all is you hate it. As a player, I mean, is the most frustrating thing is to not get a save. Now, I also agree with the people who miss open nets, because it's like not getting – it's the opposite of not getting a save, but that's a different story. So in the presser, you alluded to it. His body language was awful. He was asked a fair question about, you know, do you think it came down to not getting a save? Did you think that, you know, that was the issue? Do you think, you know, can you tell us about, you know, some of what Sandstrom's gone through this year and how he's working hard, you know, like it was kind of one of those leading questions. And he just did the shrug, throwing his hands on the podium. And it looked like he was purposely making the podium have that like microphone popping, you know, sound, right? As his answer, like, I'm not going to say it, but I want to say fuck. And, you know, this is me saying that, what I can't say. And it looked awful. So he apologizes, saying not only was it a fair question, that Sandstrom's yo-yoing this year and basically being asked to be a backup goalie wherever he goes because they're trying to develop Ersson, his competition in front of him and stuff, and he's been a great teammate and all this stuff, and I shouldn't have done that, yada, yada, yada. He sits guys. He just sat the captain for a behavior like that. So we're led to believe. And all he has to do is apologize, and we're supposed to just and the media members who are in his back pocket a lot of the times, as long as, you know, they're not the ones that are angering him, are saying, you know, Oh, what a, well, he apologized, what a stand-up guy, all this stuff. But in no apology did he say anything about how, you know, I have to have accountability too. And, you know, if this was my player, I would have sat him, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I wanted more out of him for that. I really did. And then it was compounded by after the next game, OT loss. He puts out the line. He keeps getting criticized and won't take questions on for his overtime starting lineup. Ryan Poehling, Noah Cates, and I forget who the other person was, but it's like three people you wouldn't choose to start when you have like Tippett or Frost or, you know, some guys with speed or something like that, or some skill, some finish, anything. Konechny, you know, what the hell? He doesn't even show up he sends the assistant coach to deal with it. He sends the assistant coach to answer those tough questions after he lost the game for the team. And to me, it is why, when you look at long term, Torts wasn't a good fit, because eventually that loser energy, that for anybody but me, I can give out the medicine, but I can't take the medicine. And it's not that he can't take it, like, you know, he can't take it with it. I don't care if he, you know, he's all bent out of shape about it. But I know a lot of guys who are sore losers, but when they lose, they at least take it. You know, there's a difference between being a sore loser and just like thinking you can never lose. And that when you lose, you don't actually lose. You actually win because you know, like those types of people. And that's what Torts is to me. Eventually, when things start going bad, he can't ever punish. He can't ever hold himself accountable in the same way he wants to hold others accountable. He watched the Herb Brooks Miracle on Ice movie, but he didn't finish. He didn't get the message at the end that he didn't need to do all that. Kurt Russell wasn't the hero.
How about that for an incredibly impassioned? We've had a couple of those on this show today.
Yeah. I'm just really.
He's fired up.
I'm just really tired that, like,
I mean, I didn't catch everything that happened after the Flyers game last night. So what you told me there was new information. I apologize for interrupting you, but fascinating to hear about that. And somebody even brought up like the idea that Torts is putting the assistant coaches up there so he can exit stage right, and one of them ends up assuming like the head coaching job when he exits stage right. I don't know if that's true or not, but like it's fascinating to see how Torts has handled himself in this, because like, isn't there an idea out there that, you know, a certain style of coaching, like, that was in vogue when Torts came up through the ranks and he won a Stanley Cup in 2004, like, I don't know if that particular way of doing it works anymore?
I think it does, but you gotta be willing to take your own medicine. You gotta be willing, and, like, that's, I think, his problem is, eventually, he can think his shit doesn't stink. And I think with the way the Flyers have embraced him, we got to that point a little earlier than he does. He always calls it, you know, coaches have shelf life, blah, blah, blah. It's coaches like him are abrasive. And eventually, if you're not willing to show yourself to have tough skin and to handle the abrasion that you put out, you don't get the buy-in after a while. And I think that's what happens.
I mean, there's still a chance that they make the playoffs even throughout all of this, but
sure. Yeah. But I just think personally, I think that this was a great run of like three events that kind of led into each other that shows that, you know, Torts shouldn't be the icon or the idol at the head of the cultural rebuild. It can't be about Torts. Whenever you like, we talked about culture earlier and everything, and I don't like using that word, but process. Let's use process. Good habits, good process, you know, good management, good leadership, right? Like, you can get that with the style of the leader is never the most important person. That the solutions can always happen no matter who is in that, because we know the leadership characteristics and traits and the behaviors that make a good leader. So when Tortorella is in here, somebody else steps in. I think right now it's too much. John Tortorella is the only one with the answer, or the only one with his finger on the pulse to know when to give tough love and when not to, and who to give it to and who to lean into and who to pull back from, when to be a dick and when not to. It can't just be him. And I think right now the fans, the media for sure, and the fans for sure, and I think even inside the organization, they are believing that he's the one with the answer, and they don't necessarily have the answer themselves, or they can't have it without him or without following his way.
You know what? You know what's interesting about it? And I think about, because when we talked about Torts vis-a-vis the Panthers, and I don't want to bring everything back to this, but like, the culture was already set in a way, even after what happened in the 22 playoffs, so that when Paul Maurice came in, you know, he evolved and changed as a coach, and he'll readily admit if he screwed up. Like, there are multiple examples this year where he's like, I didn't coach well enough. And I think that's one of the things that is very important to me when I'm evaluating coaches. Like, you've got to be willing to admit about your own flaws. That's coaching, that's management, that's ownership, that's all of it. And if you don't do it, then it is a sign that something could be off. And I think John Tortorella not wanting in some ways to admit that maybe he stepped over the line, maybe he, like, you know, and not letting, you know, the media ask those tough questions to him, having the assistants do it. Like, I understand what he's thinking. I understand the logic behind it. But, you know, if you're going to do the stuff with Couturier, if you're going to have the stuff with Felix Sandstrom where, you know, you don't have the poker face and your body language was what it was, like, everyone could tell. He did apologize for it, and that's good. But then with this game, this really big game, to not come out and speak afterwards, like, I don't think that John Tortorella gets the message that he's sending, don't you think? Like, it's a message that I don't think he is intending to send, but it is being sent anyway. And you compare it to, as we, you know, come full circle in the show, what Paul Maurice has talked about and the message he's sending and the consistency of that, because he knows who's listening and he knows who the message is intended for. Like, I think John Tortorella might not be in as good a control of his own message right now as he thinks he is, and that, when you are the centerpiece of what the Flyers are trying to do, and this rebuild that's not based on players, it's based on this coach to set the culture in some ways because he is the most famous name, right? If you're not in control of your own message, or you've lost control of the narrative, so to speak, then you could reach a point where what that means is, like, you will start to lose the dressing room. And I can understand if there are Flyers players in there who are, you know, who he preaches accountability to all the time, but who is John Tortorella accountable to at this point, right? Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I think when you have that accountability, if there's disagreements or players who are, I mean, there's always going to be, they're competitive players. There's always going to be players not playing, so that means there's going to be players not happy with their ice time. And when there's that respect from the front office to the coaching staff to the players, you don't hear, you know, there's not the Couturier feeding. I mean, Couturier has never really fed those types of quotes to the media before. He was trying to say something, and that is concerning. Because that shows the disconnect. When you feel like you can communicate, when you feel like you can have those conversations and handle it internally, that stuff does not happen in the media. And the one thing I really agree with is it does seem like Tortorella is maybe driving and influencing things a lot more on his own than Maurice is. Maurice is a coach. He's important. There's a lot of things that he really does know the best, and the Panthers front office is set up to allow him those decisions and that that influence.
Here's another buzzword I want to mention here. It is alignment. You know, that's a buzzword you're hearing a lot. Like, the Panthers are very clearly aligned in their structure, and a lot of great teams are aligned in their structure and the way they're doing business. What this Flyers situation is showing to me is that there's a misalignment somewhere.
Well, because they went with the coach first. They went with the coach first. They went coach, like, the coach is the one that was defining the culture and everything. When Maurice was getting hired, it was, are you fitting what we want to do? Can you fit this? Can you take this? Can you, like, we're missing, this is what we want to do, and this is what we're missing. Can you provide this for us? They, like, Zito, the ownership, the rest of the front office that was there that was making these this hiring decision, they knew what they wanted to do. They knew they needed somebody to guide them and have the cachet and the respect from NHL players to do it. But they didn't need – John Tortorella is telling Danny Briere and Keith Jones of more of what to do than Maurice is, for example. I would bet that is 100% the case. Not saying that Keith Jones and Danny Briere aren't in charge or don't have say or don't make their own choices, but I think when it comes to what do we want our hockey players to do, or how do we want our hockey players to play, or what skills do we want to scout in our hockey players, John Tortorella starts that conversation more than Danny Briere and Keith Jones based on the way they're building the culture from the outside appearances. We know that Zito's pro scouts, Zito's amateur scouts, the front office, had models of what type of players they wanted, had models of what traits they thought will have, you know, good hardworking habits, playoff hockey, and that kind of stuff. They need somebody to bring that out, the traits out onto the ice and get it consistent and motivate the guys and that kind of stuff.
Do you feel like in some ways this is more because Tortorella is the centerpiece of all of this, the royal this?
It's
you know, the communication's a little more run, a little bit more, it's not as, like with Maurice and the Panthers, it's even, it's a two-way conversation.
Who's the president in Florida?
It's a business guy, it's Matt Caldwell.
Right. He's not telling Bill Zito. Once Zito is hired, Matt Caldwell does not tell Bill Zito what to do in a hockey. Bill Zito might ask him for business advice and things like that. But, you know, Keith Jones is the president. That's a hockey person with a hockey ideas, with locker room NHL experience, telling Danny Briere, GM, who's a hockey guy with locker room and winning experience, doing the moves. And then you have Tortorella, who's very opinionated, very entrenched in the hockey culture and what he thinks is the right way to do stuff. And all three of those people were hired independently of each other to do independent things, and they probably have their own ideas. The president is aligned with our GM, is aligned with our coach, and the focal point is the GM. The general manager. So our general picture and our general processes are way more aligned, and it shows. Obviously, they also have like a year head start, but I also think they've made better decisions and they had more to work with to begin with, obviously.
Well, so I think it's just a matter of, it's so fascinating because of the way it blew up for the last regime and why Tortorella was hired, right? We remember what the decision-making process was to hire him, and it was to get more out of a group that, you know, you weren't getting a ton out of. But it was also because that regime thought that the Flyers were better than they actually were.
They wanted to bring life and passion back into the market. That's the whole idea behind a new era of Orange, right? So they brought in a spark plug. They basically only had corporate sponsors and the suits and the and those people showing up to games. No, the Fletcher was so boring and so stale. The team was so stale. They didn't have talent. They didn't have high picks. They needed life. So they went out and got Tortorella, and then they started building off of that piece by piece. That, I mean, that if you look at Philadelphia, they are on much more precarious ground. They're like a Buffalo rebuild. They're like, you know, there's so many different types of rebuilds that happen. And when you don't really commit, when you don't have a unified one plan, it always backfires, I think, because it deteriorates. There's attrition. It rips apart. You have less buy-in. You can say whatever you want about the blueprint. It didn't work. It wasn't as successful as it could have been. Talon wasn't the best guy in the end to get it over the line, blah, blah, blah. But it was a unified one vision that everybody believed in, and it built the core pieces. And it got them to a point where they had a chance to make it happen. They got further than Buffalo did. And everybody thought Buffalo was so smart around the same time as the blueprint. That, you know, like, so, and again, you know, use specific examples. You can get caught in the details and get, you know, analysis paralysis in that and trying to do
another full circle moment for this podcast. Yeah,
but like, you know, the Flyers, I think if you look at a 36,000 feet view of the Flyers franchise, they made a lot of good decisions. They made a lot of bad decisions. You can connect the lines between some of them. But if you look at it from the top down and everything, it's not always unified. They're sometimes competing interests. There's sometimes step forwards and then step backs. Where with the Panthers, it was, you look at it and it looks organized. It looks like this builds into that, the flow, the upwards trajectory.
Well, I mean, look, if you remember from 8 years ago, 7 years ago, when we were doing this podcast and I had a very famous rant about ownership and what they did in 16-17 and the bad decisions that they made, and they made a lot of bad decisions then. Like, I don't know if I would go on the rant the way I did then, but it was clear that there was no alignment in that organization at the time.
You can see how it's changed.
And who, but you can see how it's changed.
Who was at the public opening for the new practice arena?
Yeah, the owner was there.
The owner was. I didn't see him cutting the ribbon. I saw Caldwell. I saw Zito. I saw a lot of the people who probably did the work to make it happen. A lot, you know. But this was a political glad handing. This was a good chance for him to get pictures and press and be featured in the paper and stuff. And, you know, you didn't see the two owners there.
Well, it's like even last year, like the only time you saw Viola was when Gretzky interviewed him during the final. Like that was really it. And like, and I think we joke a lot about the Tampa, like that's the other problem with the Flyers is they are owned by corporate interests. So there isn't a face of that. You know what I mean? Like for a lot of teams, like that owner there is a face. You know, yeah. And you can cast your dispersions or glory or whatever you want on a face. Like, it's very difficult to do that with Comcast, you know, with the Flyers, right?
Zito can sit down and be like, listen, Vinny, you know what's really cool? Being the man behind the throne. You know, it's, you know, like, when you talk about all this old money and you talk about all these old, you know, you spin a yarn and you sell it. It's hard to do that with a corporation, where corporations definitely do not give up control of things. They always want to be involved. They want to make sure they're meeting their numbers. They want to make sure that when they don't meet their numbers, they have the leverages.
And you know what's interesting about this point? I think I'll wrap up on this because it's a thread that we can pull for another day. Like, when you look at Toronto and what's happened with the Maple Leafs and, you know, Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment being two-thirds owned by the two biggest media, telecom, whatever, in Canada, competing corporate interests, like how you might not have thought that was a Kyle Dubas show or a Brad Tree Living show. It's a Brendan Shanahan show, but Brendan Shanahan is reporting up to a president of MLSE who has to answer to a board that is stacked by the two largest media companies and two of the most valuable companies, an oligopoly essentially in Canada. Like, you're answering to something else, right? And I think for the Flyers, because they obviously replaced, you know, the head of Spectacor, right? You know, Camillo's gone. They replaced they have a new one, right? Hilferty, I think. Yes. So, like, he's still trying to, I think, figure out, like, what is it that we want? You know, and it's alignment is the word. If you haven't started hearing this word in sports discussion as a word like culture you're going to get sick of, I promise you alignment is going to get there. You're going to get sick of this word really fast. But it's so important because if you're not aligned and the misalignment, you can see it very clearly right now with the Flyers and why I think the Tortorella experiment is probably not going to last a whole lot longer. I mean, they might make the playoffs this year and lose, whatever. But, like, it feels like there's a lot of tension building up there, and that tension's going to have to be released somehow, and it's not Briere and Jones that are going to go. It's going to be the coach, right? Like, that lack of alignment is killer. And, you know, and I'll end it on this. You know how we made our joke about how Vinny Viola's favorite team is the Tampa Bay Lightning for years? Like, what is the secret to what Vinny Viola was looking at with Tampa? What has Jeff Vinnick done? He's empowered the hockey people to do their job, and he's like, I'm going to give you all the resources you need, and I'm going to let you guys do what you need to do. I'm giving you the tools, I'm giving you the structure, but otherwise, this is your baby. You go take care of it. And it's really worked. Like, there's the difference between being a hands-off owner like that, and I don't know if you read the Aaron Portsline story. By the way, congratulations on him getting a kidney donor. That's fantastic. We wish nothing but the best for Aaron Portsline. Did you see the piece he wrote in The Athletic about the Blue Jackets mess and why they're this horrific franchise? And I read that, and I, like, it comes from alignment. It comes from that unified connective tissue that you have to have. And there are going to be differences depending on who your owner is, depending on what their goals are, you know.
It comes from buying the John Davidson sales pitch for the 20th year in a row with
like, when you think about
spin.
Yeah, right. But when you think about all of that put together, there's no one way to win. You know, Bill Foley's won. You have the Colorado Avalanche winning when that Avalanche team is one of five different teams Stan Kroenke owns, and I guarantee you he probably couldn't name the general manager of the Colorado Avalanche without someone telling it to him, you know, because he's got five other teams going on. Like, there are different ways to do this. But the most important thing is there has to be some level of alignment. There has to be some level of connective tissue and connectivity with everybody. And what you see with the Flyers and what you pointed out, I think, is the beginning stages of that alignment breaking. And the alignment is breaking through the coach. And the coach is not necessarily 100% aligned with the visions that is coming from above him, because he is the longest tenured among all of them. He's been in his job longer than the GM, the president of hockey ops, and the president of Spectacore. And that is the challenge. Now, if you build a culture, not even the top down, but if you fit that alignment and everybody can see the same, you know, or is reading from the same hymn sheet, essentially, if we're going to go on a British phrase, like, then it does it. Like, then you can plop someone into that structure, and if you find the right fit, it can work. But that is the challenge that is facing the Flyers right now, and who are they going to give up on sooner, right?
If you're building a culture, you should it should never be built around a replaceable part. A player and a coach is a replaceable part. They will always be changing. If we're building a culture, the idea is to be good through multiple cores, which means multiple coaches, multiple players and everything. So you can't build it around a coach. It has to be able to function with different parts.
Yeah, John Cooper's the exception, not the rule. Like,
well, I mean, I think Tampa will function if they continue to do the same things. I think they'll function fine with or without John Cooper.
Like, that's the other point.
They'll function fine with or without Steven Stamkos, with or without Kucherov, if they can continue the process. Because if they continue the process, they will get another Stamkos, they will get another Kucherov. There will always be good hockey players. I mean, Real Madrid. I love using that example lately, but you know, like, they will find a new coach. They will find the new best players.
I mean, example, as much as I scoffed at it, like, if you compare Real Madrid and Barcelona in terms of how they're being run, there is no comparison right now. Like, one is run fairly decently for being one of the wealthiest clubs in the world, and the other is FC Barcelona, which is not that.
Barcelona was built around the idea that Cruyff's midfield, having dominant midfielders, the best midfielders, and playing a certain way works. And it does, if you have the best midfielders. But when they're all gone and you can't replace them and you don't have any money because you spent everything paying...
Pull the lever, Kronk.
Yep. You know, Real Madrid's still good because they told Cristiano Ronaldo, we're not going to give you as much as Messi because it'll bankrupt us. And guess what? It would have. You know, they were like, we can win another way. We know what processes to repeat. We know what works. We can win another way. And they did. They already have.
That's, I didn't expect Real Madrid and Barca to come up here. But anyway, thank you very much for listening. We will have more to come as we get closer to the playoffs. And who will John Tortorella scratch next? Maybe we'll find out. I don't know if I want to know that, but we'll see. Until then, of course, here's a part of the Flyers culture that was aligned. Good night and good hockey.